comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
As nighttime settles across the Western Hemisphere, it's time once again to welcome you to talk radio like nowhere else on earth. Welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. We're here because you have a right to know and because you matter. Tonight is Watch Free Night, and what that means is you can watch the Kevin Smith Show tonight for free. So if you're interested in doing that, just go over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and you'll see the link that says Watch for Free Tonight. Click on that, and voila, you will be watching for free. We do that once or twice a month, and we invite you to join us each night watching the Kevin Smith Show. All you have to do is join our members area. It's only 23 cents a day. Absolutely rock-bottom cost. 23 cents a day, $6.95 a month. And there's a whole lot more than just watching the show for free. And there's a whole lot more than just watching the show in the members area. Because in the members area, if you're not able to catch the show when we do it live, well, you can watch the recording of it. For the next 24 hours after we do the show, you have your own blog page, your own photo gallery, your friends page, your own profile page, private messaging, forums, chat room, video galaxy, a lot of stuff. 23 cents a day. So I hope you join us. It's a good group of people in there. We've had a number of people requesting, you know, I've been talking about how we were going to play the Gods in the Garden seminar. We were going to televise that again this last weekend, and we're doing it again this weekend in the members area. Okay? And so I've had a number of requests where people have asked me where can they get the book, and a number of requests where can they get the ebook. Now, we don't offer that as an ebook very often. We don't I don't promote it much. But it's available right now, and it's going to be available on the website through Saturday. The reason we don't promote that very much is because I don't want the book to take over the show. I don't want the book to become the big thing. The big thing is the Kevin Smith Show. The book is available if you want it. It's $9. It's available through Saturday. I recommend that you get it. If you haven't gotten it, if you haven't read it, I recommend that you do so, because it will take you on a ride, the likes of which I can almost guarantee you have not been on. The K-Files is our free weekly newsletter. If you have not yet subscribed to the free weekly newsletter here at the Kevin Smith Show, please do. I mean, you can unsubscribe anytime you want to. But it's truly free, and it's a publication that most people, when they subscribe, they stay with us forever. A few people unsubscribe. That's normal. That's natural. But most people stay with us forever, and there's truly no genius in being in the dark when you really don't have to be in the dark, is there? There's no genius in not knowing what's going on here, because it's always got the inside scoop from the Kevin Smith Show. It's got articles of interest within our genre and links to videos of interest within our genre and a lot of other stuff. So subscribe tonight at kevinsmithshow.com. It's called The K-Files. We'll be back right after this. My guest this evening rocketed to national fame with his investigations into Area 51 and with his accurate predictions about the 1989 San Francisco earthquake and then subsequently several other rather spectacular earthquakes. He is a natural psychic, a trained remote viewer, and he's a television and film producer. My guest is Sean David Morton. Sean, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Are you with us, Sean? Well, he was there, folks, just a moment ago, and I have no idea what has happened. Okay, let's try again. Are you with us, Sean? Well, that's interesting. So I will... Okay, Sean, you could not hear me?
Oh, I can. I can hear you now.
I can hear you on the speakerphone, but you could not hear me. All right, well, let's give it another try.
Okay, I got nothing.
Okay.
I'm in a dark space, a very lonely
place. A very dark space. Okay, and I have no idea when that's happening, but I will tell you that what we're going to do is going to be a little antiquated in order for me to do this, but we're going to make this work, and then during the next break, we'll fix it up. So, Sean, I've just introduced you and welcomed you to the show. Let me allow you to speak to the audience, and again, welcome to the show. Well, he... apparently cannot hear me. Sean, I've just spoken to the audience and welcomed you to the show. So I'm going to push a button, and I'll say again, welcome to the show.
Okay.
All right. Now, Sean, I've told the audience about you being very well known for having accurately predicted the 1989 San Francisco earthquake, the Kobe, Japan earthquake, and several others. And of course, it's big in the news right now about, and will be, I guess, for a number of years, this gigantic earthquake that struck Japan. Did you see this one coming?
Hello?
Yes, did you see this earthquake coming?
I did not predict the earthquake in Japan. It was a, it was a kind of a strange thing because we were actually on a cruise. We had about 300 people or so, and so we were on a boat. So the interesting thing about it is that when you're on a cruise and on one of these boats, you're kind of sick to your stomach all the time, and the boat's rocking back and forth, and you're a little off kilter. So it's a lot like what being Irish is pretty much like all the time. So it's you get this kind of weird sort of drunk feeling.
Right.
So anything that was going on with me, I mean, this was just a very strange thing. We were doing a lot of we were working a lot of energy and doing a lot of things actually while we were there. But it was very, very strange when the quake actually hit that you're actually talking about the a country that has the most advanced earthquake detection systems on Earth, and they were bragging about the fact that this particular quake was better recorded than any other large quake in history. So the fact that you had a 176-mile rip in the Earth's crust that was 176 miles long and approximately 27 miles wide or so, with absolutely no warning whatsoever. One of the things that I had been talking about, so in terms of actually feeling it, again, usually what I do is I work with maps in something that's called, something that's called cartography, or psychic cartography, where you work with maps and you can actually predict, and I teach people how to do this, where you can actually predict where certain quakes are. So again, this is a quake that I cannot take credit for. There were a number of other people that I know that did predict the quake, like Reverend James Capers actually was in Japan, and he got the date a little bit off. And there were some very interesting predictions made by a gentleman by the name of Benjamin Fulford, who also talked about a very large artificial quake hitting Japan should certain political things actually occur. So one of the things that I did talk about extensively, and I hope you can hear me because I can't hear anything from the other side. I'm just sort of talking into this void. So, and I'm hearing clicking on the other lines.
We can hear you just fine. Go ahead.
Okay, because you're hitting a button here, and I'm just kind of going back and forth. So it's very odd. There's no, I'm just kind of talking into space here. So what I'd been talking about for several months before this was that it is my opinion that from what it is that I have seen with a massive amount of money that's been disappearing from not only from the economy but the Federal Reserve printing trillions of dollars, which is just vanishing. The fact that in 2008, on September 11th, between 9 a.m. and about 11 a.m. or so, just to show you that the same guys that were probably behind the World Trade Center attacks in 2001, on September 11th of 2008, spiked the computer systems and literally stole about $3.5 trillion out of the world economy. And at that time, had there not been certain stops put into the system. There was a movie that was done about it with John Travolta and Holly Berry that was called Swordfish. And in essence, what was used, and you're probably familiar with this, Kevin, but in my opinion, what was used was the Promise 2 software, which was a software that many people believed was also used to black out the East Coast on August 13th of 2003. But this software was actually used to backdoor and spike the computers and literally steal about $3.5 trillion out of the world economy. And would have taken all of it, would have taken anywhere between 6 to 8 trillion or so, had they not actually been stopped on that particular day. But one of the things that I've noticed is that the things that I know that the guys on the inside are very worried about, and I then begin to notice how technology is being used to address those particular things. And I don't want to sound like I'm working for the secret government or something, and I'm one of the Rockefellers or the Rothschilds or whatever else. I am always the person that throughout my career of doing this has always been the voice of reason. One of the reasons why I started putting my newsletter together, my Delphi Associates newsletter back in 1993, was to kind of debunk and go against many of the prophecies and predictions of people like Dolores Cannon, who I personally don't like, so I'm not going to talk about it at all. Guys like Gordon Michael Scallion, who I have a great deal of respect for. And Gordon was the Mac Daddy of earthquake predictors up until the Landers quake of 1992. And then everything shifted and a timeline shifted and some very interesting things have gone on. So there's a lot of people that claim that the insiders or the Bilderbergers or the Illuminati or the Incunabula or whatever it is you want to call them have been using this super technology to somehow destroy the world or somehow wipe out the global population or bring the global population down to 500 million or so and wiping out the useless eaters, et cetera, et cetera. And yet all I have seen is demonstrations of a massively powerful super technology that has been used to create smaller disasters so that larger disasters don't readily occur. And the three things, my premise now is that the three things that they're the most worried about, and it seems to me we have to worry about in 2012. And the fascinating part about this is that now you have all this prophecy coming together with science and physics and astronomy and astrophysics. This is not a Y2K kind of deal where everybody thought the lights were going to go off, even though they spent close to $200 billion actually fixing that problem beginning in the early 90s or so. And I was one of the first people to actually talk about it, saying, look, there's a problem here that needs to be fixed. And I continued to say, look, they're spending the money to fix the problem now, and so everything's going to be fine when Y2K rolls around because they've done what it is they were supposed to do. So what they're worried about is they're worried about a massive number of solar flares coming up in what they call Cycle 24. And this astrophysics aspect of it then links to not only the Mayan pyramids of Chichen Itza and Tikal and Palenque and all that, and the Yucatan and in Guatemala, where they point to the December 21st, 2012 time date of some shift of the calendar, but also to a very, very heavy-duty prediction inside the Great Pyramid of Giza, where in an area 151 feet beneath the pyramid itself, in what they call the Well of Souls or the Pit, there's a trough that directly relates to the years 2012 to 2014. And as you enter the pit, the time coding of the pit is such that it represents a great trial or a great tribulation in the 20th century. And if you understand the sacred geometry going into it that an initiate literally is crawling on his hands and knees from about the year 1500 until you hit about 1900 or so, where you can then stand up in the pit. There is a warning or a lip or an edge on the pit that shows that late 2004 to 2005 would be a series of water-related catastrophes or disasters that were designed to warn mankind, to give us sort of some one last harbinger, if you will, of the various disasters that were going to come down. Those that turn away from falling into the pit in 2004, 2005, then come around the pit and think that everything's fine and that they've managed to escape, and then suddenly a series of dire disasters, which actually is called the River of Fire, then washes a third of humanity down into the pit, occurring between 2012 and approximately 2014 or so. And it gets really disconcerting when you have the Undersecretary of Defense actually stand up in front of a whole group of astrophysicists and say, look, we're expecting a massive solar flare, a kill shot type solar flare, to occur in February of 2013. And all these physicists are jumping up and down saying, well, you know, how do you come by this? And he basically said, I know what I know, and packed up his stuff and left the meeting. So
when did that happen?
Looking at not only a massive solar flare activity, but the other thing that they were worried about is that magnetic north and true north are moving towards each other. And this began in 1945 when we started dropping atomic bombs on the planet, and we've now dropped well over 10,000 nuclear bombs, including cobalt bombs, hydrogen bombs, 1,700 nuclear weapons we've dropped on Nevada, a bunch more on New Mexico. So what they discovered when they were actually mapping the polar grid of the North Pole under something called Project Nanook with Major Maynard E. White, is that when they started mapping the North Poles in order to open them up for commercial air travel, they discovered that the magnetic North Pole, which had been perfectly stable and very fine, thank you very much, from about when it was first discovered in, I think, 1832 to 1945, had been stable, and then suddenly it had become, as they described it, untethered from the Earth's core, and that magnetic north was now moving towards geologic north. And the studies that they did as part of Project Nanook, and there was actually a book that the son of Major White gave me, Kenny White, which is called World in Peril, that I've talked about since the early 90s. It was published in 1994. But I've been talking about this book for many, many, many years on all the radio shows I've been on, and Richard Hoagland has kind of picked up the book and made it his cause celebre. Is the true north and magnetic north were marching towards each other. And when they began to study this phenomenon, the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica built a series of mock-ups, if you will, of the planet, finding that in about 60% of the cases where true north and magnetic north met, that the model literally experienced an electromagnetic polar shift where the north-south pole on the model actually then physically shifted. In about 30% of the tests, the actual model itself rolled over on its side, leaving the new north pole being somewhere around Radai, Saudi Arabia. And in about 10%, just nothing happened. It actually just caused what they then projected as being a massive number of weather disturbances and whatever else.
Okay, look, before we get too far away from something that you said, I want you to sort of elaborate on it. You talked about this meeting where the Undersecretary of State or Undersecretary of Defense makes a statement about a kill shot solar flare coming. Elaborate on that for us just a little bit. When did this happen?
The mystery of it is, and I'll send you the I don't have it directly in front of me, but I'll send you the link on it. Richard Hoagland has been talking for quite some time, and my friend Mike Barra, they did a book called Dark Mission, and what they've been talking about for a while is that when the sun begins to directly align with galactic center, that, and of course this is a phenomenon it's the first time this is going to happen in about 26,000 years or so. There are many people who believe that there is going to be an energy pulse that is actually going to then strike the Earth. There are people that call it a graviton pulse, various things, but some kind of massive wave of energy. The interesting thing about it, what this theory pretends, is that there is a dark star that literally about 500 astronomical units out. And there's a lot of people that talk that they claim that it's Planet X or Marduk or that it's something coming towards us. But what the body of evidence really points towards is that we have a twin, that the sun actually has a twin, this dark star that they call Nemesis, which is in essence sort of a dark brown dwarf that's actually out there about 500 units out. So it's not just the alignment of the sun with galactic center that we have to worry about, but Hoagland has been talking for quite some time about that when the Earth moves through January, February, March, the spring of 2013, that galactic center is also going to line up with this solar twin, this Nemesis, if you will, and that the pulse of energy from the center of the galaxy, this mile across black hole, is not only going to line up with the sun, but that supposedly this massive strike is going to occur when supposedly when this dark star actually lines up to it. But I will get you the quote from the Undersecretary of Defense, where he talked about this at this meeting and caused quite a big fuss, where he was talking about February of 2013 was what we had to worry about, and that was when he felt that the solar flare phenomenon was going to be at its worst, and that's when we should kind of panic. And it caused quite a hubbub at this meeting. So let me get you the information on that, Kevin. So I'll send you the link to that, because I don't have it right with me right on the moment.
Okay. We're about a minute and a half away from break. So I want to make sure that I understand what you're saying. You're saying that with magnetic north moving toward the geographical North Pole, when they meet, we can expect some type of a polar shift. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. Can you hear me now?
Uh-huh.
Okay. All right. Here's what's happened, and this is why I need to explain this. What's been happening from 1945 until approximately 2010 is that magnetic north and true north have been moving towards each other. And I know we've only got a minute here, but something happened in 2010 that literally grabbed hold of the energy from the center of the Earth, and now the North Pole has now taken a hard right turn. It's probably been listening to a little much Fox News or Rush Limbaugh or something, but magnetic north has taken a massive right turn and is now heading not north, but east towards Siberia, and magnetic north has now moved or shifted more than 100 miles or so. And I've been the first one I've been talking about this for, you know, since 2010. Since it first happened, and now it's just finally starting to make the newspapers as they're having to start to realign. It made the first national press in Florida in the Tampa Tribune, because they had to start talking about actually realigning all of the runways at the Tampa airport, because nothing's lining up to magnetic north anymore, as magnetic north is actually now shifted and is now moving east instead of north. And this happened in late 2009 through 2010. This happened.
All right, we have to take a break, and we're going to step away. We will be back, ladies and gentlemen, right after this, so don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Sean David Morton. And during the break, he and I worked on this telephone audio situation. Maybe it will work. We will see. So, Sean, let me just ask if you can hear me at this point.
Yes, thank you. It's much better. You sound like you're very far away, and when I talk, I can hear kind of an echo. But it's much better than just talking into a black hole in space. So thanks for fixing it, Kevin. I appreciate it.
Well, okay, that's a good thing. All right, we were talking about the magnetic north moving toward geographical north, and that when they match, when they meet up. All the models, or at least about 60% of the models, I think you said,
yes,
show that there will be a magnetic polar shift. That would mean that our compasses are pointing one direction right now to show north, and they'll be pointing in the opposite direction to show north after the magnetic pole shift. Is that right?
Well, it also means that, I mean, it's just not that easy. It means that everything, every electrical device that we have that runs at 60 cycles, that then is connected to a ground wire, because everything has to be grounded out at 7.83 hertz, which is the Schulman resonance. It means that virtually every electrical device on Earth that's not either shielded or running at a running at a frequency that's near the Schulman resonance will basically burn out. I mean, there is a Hopi prophecy that talks about how all of our electrical devices will turn against us. But that's kind of the terror scenario of what's going on. And what my what I'm trying to say is that the biggest thing that they're worried about is either a physical polar shift, an electromagnetic polar shift, and massive activity that's actually coming out of the sun as part of something called Cycle 24, where astrophysicists are now telling us that, and once again, these are the guys who are watching the sun through SOHO, and these are the people that are really freaking out about it. And again, these are not 2012 people or you know, or prophets or people that are trying to create panic. They're telling us that Cycle 24, the cycle that's now coming up, is going to be quite possibly the worst solar cycle in terms of coronal mass ejections and cosmic radiation and things happening with the sun in 14,500 years. And when they say that, if you go back 14,500 years, their claim is that there was a massive solar flare that wiped out most of life on Earth as we know it. And once again, this is science telling us that supposedly there were only about 2,000 survivors of this flare from 14,500 years ago, and that we're all descended from those survivors. And where we look for evidence of this is down in the various artwork of the Aborigines in Australia, who once again around that time have all kinds of artwork and cave paintings and various sky gods that have to do with this gigantic solar flare. But there's things being done to fix everything. This is where I'm in kind of a weird position here, because there's all these people. I mean, I seem to be the only voice of reason, where so many people who are making money and getting up on the radio and talking about how it's all going to be death and it's going to be destruction and millions will die, and that the Bilderbergers just want to slaughter everybody on the planet, and yet every single time they talk about something, some kind of massive plague or some kind of or some kind of planet-killing sort of, you know, fear-inducing scenario. You know, one, we notice that it never really comes to pass. Two, I'm the person who keeps saying, well, if they own us all and we're really kind of their slaves on the plantation, are the masters really going to come out of the house with the shotguns and start shooting the people picking cotton in the fields when, you know, they own us lock, stock, and barrel? Now, when that will probably happen is when we get out of the box and when everybody basically gets off the reservation. And like what you're seeing in the Middle East, and with that spirit of revolution that's about ready to spread to the United States. And this is something that is predicted by the Mayan prophecies. You know, the Mayans talk about this final wave, this pulse of energy that is going to come at us between actually right now and December 21st of 2012. The prediction is that one man will no longer be the slave of another, that the cosmic winds will wash away hierarchies, that the cosmic brain of the East and West, in other words, the Eastern intuitive mind represented by China and Asia and Tibet and Nepal and India, if you will, eventually begins to combine with the logical, didactic Western mind. So when everybody starts talking about the re-empowerment of the goddess, and everybody starts talking about the return of the white buffalo calf woman, or the Emanuela, or the twin flame of Christ, or the female pulse of the blue magnetic strand of the Quetzalcoatl DNA, all of this, or the redemption of Eve, is all about re-energizing the right-hand side of the brain, which is where we exist in quantum time, it's where we have empathy, it's where we have telepathy, you know, it's where all of these mental powers to be able to see the future and the past all exist. And the theory is there has been a veil over this side of the brain for the last 12,500 years or so, or possibly 26,000 years or so. And then everything that is about ready to come up is all about the next cycle that we're entering into, pulling back that veil.
Okay, let me ask you a question about the veil.
Yes, sir.
Who installed it?
Good question. If you look at Egyptian mythology says, and once again, let's talk, if we talk about Isis and Osiris, that the Great Pyramid of Giza, the entrance to the Great Pyramid of Giza, the fall of man, if you will, has these two huge chevrons over it. In other words, these two stones that look kind of like an upside-down Standard Oil symbol, if you will. So the representation of Adam and Eve in the garden, where Eve is talking to the snake, and she bites the apple, and then she gets Adam to bite the apple, and then God says, "Who made you do this?" And he points his finger and says, "Her, she's the one that made me do it." God said that, okay, you know, woman, your punishment is pain in childbirth, monthly pain, and be doomed to drink diet soft drinks for as long as you shall live. And Adam, your punishment is you got to put up with her now. And I think that's probably why God is probably mad at the gays, because they found a loophole in that contract somewhere. But the idea is that the serpent represented, and once again, this is the Egyptian mythology, represented a race of extraterrestrials called the Alpha Draconians. And the Alpha Draconians, who come from a star system called Thuban, that was the North Star at the time that aligned with the downward path into the pyramid. And the downward path into the pyramid, since we're on kind of a fun extraterrestrial show where we can talk about this, the downward path into the pyramid represented the fall of man. And this was about 2652 B.C., which just so happened to coincide with the rule of Khufu, otherwise known as Cheops, who's the pharaoh that gets the credit for supposedly building the pyramid, when in essence all he really did was kind of redecorate it and actually kind of spiff it up and make it kind of nice. But the idea is that these Alpha Draconians, these reptiles, are somehow responsible for the fall of man. And how man falls is that we fall because we begin to be obsessed with our physical forms. We get divided. In other words, the veil gets installed in that part of the brain which allows us access to greater time and space, and as you go through the time coding of the pyramids, supposedly beings from the Pleiades are then responsible for, because all the uplifting stuff, the things that represent man's salvation, all seem to align with the constellation of the Seven Sisters or the Pleiades. And then if you want to link that into, the Billy Meyer UFO case in Switzerland, or the Adrien UFO case in Miami, who was a gentleman that I was very close to and very good friends with for a while, there seems to be that kind of extraterrestrial help that is assisting us in evolving. So, or it could also just be, as far as the installation of the veil, it could just be a natural, a natural pulse of the universe that we go through days of light and nights of darkness. And so this has been the night of darkness, and now we're getting into the next phase, which is going to be the next day of light, or the next golden age, which is coming very soon.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah. So that brings me back to Japan now.
Okay.
Since this massive earthquake and very destructive tsunami in Japan, there have been hundreds of reports of UFO sightings. Hundreds. If not thousands, in Japan. When I say UFO, many people think of that as being extraterrestrial, although we know that not all objects in the sky which are unidentified are in fact extraterrestrial. Some of them are ours. But with hundreds, close to 1,000, maybe over 1,000 by now, it's doubtful that all those are ours. So we will, for the sake of discussion, assume that they are extraterrestrial. Why does it seem that they are so interested in a disaster?
Well, they didn't actually start with the Japan earthquake in March. They started with the riots and the revolution in Egypt and Tunisia. On the same, the riots and revolution in in Tunisia began when you had a fellow who ran a fruit cart that couldn't afford the permits, that then was getting beaten up by a local policeman on a pretty daily basis, and started this macabre game of cat and mouse where he was just trying to feed his family. A well-educated man, under 30, 70% of the population of Tunisia is actually under the age of 30, who was trying to support his family against President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali's government, who then lit himself on fire, and this became literally a YouTube, Facebook sensation, which then triggered this revolution across the Middle East. On January 28th, the same day that this happened, he lit himself on fire actually, it was December 17th, I believe of 2010. And then when the riots actually then began in earnest in Egypt, the same day the riots were happening, this is January 28th in Egypt, you had the YouTube video that's become very famous of the UFOs over the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, which was actually taken by a fellow I know, a friend of mine, who actually runs a shop on top of the he's a Palestinian guy who actually runs a shop on top of the Mount of Olives, who actually he and his family took the video, where you see this UFO that comes down over the Dome of the Rock, and then lights up the entire area and then shoots back up into the sky. The rest of the video is for the better part of an hour or so. There's an entire fleet of ships that is actually just blinking in the sky over Jerusalem. At the same time that's happening, you have a massive wave of UFOs that occurs over Mexico. And within the last couple of weeks, you also, because I've been talking about the sun, you have also had SOHO, which is the Solar Heliotropic Observatory, has been photographing gigantic ships. We're talking planet-sized craft actually in orbit around the sun. And the person that has been reporting on these, because he's now he's the best UFO investigator on Earth, because he's really one of the few people that really gets paid to investigate the phenomenon, is my friend Jaime Masson. And Jaime is, who runs the Mexican version of 60 Minutes. And he featured an entire story on a massive fleet of craft around the sun. And I was told as far back as 1995-96, when I was very good friends with a Pleiadian UFO contactee who was a Cuban immigrant who called himself Audrian, as far back as then, he was giving me prophecies and predictions saying that there was something wrong with the sun, that the Pleiadians were trying to fix the sun, and that something was going to go crazy with the sun in 2012 or 2014 if somebody doesn't fix it. Now, Japan, not only do you have the challenge with Japan, the country's got about 55 nuclear reactors. You had four nuclear reactors actually meltdown in Japan. And again, these are...
All right, well, Sean, we have to step away for a break. We'll pick up right there with the nuclear reactors in Japan when we come back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Sean David Morton. Now, when we went away for break, Sean, we were talking about Japan. They've got 55 nuclear facilities, and you were getting into that, and then the break took over. So the floor is yours.
Okay. So, what's happening there is that on the one hand, they haven't so far had a Chernobyl-style meltdown. They've had releases of massive releases of gas or uncontrolled releases of the radioactive gas. It's worse than they're letting on, but it's not as bad as it could be. And the effect that it had, if you really want to look behind the scenes, is that part of Obama's big plan was, and I'm not going to talk about politics at all, I'm just going to talk about the reality of what's happening, is that they were counting on a number of clean nuclear plants in the United States that were based on the French model that have been running perfectly well and very, very safely for the last 30 years in Europe. And the day these earthquakes happened, and the nuclear facilities began going down, we are talking about a loss in the economy of about $8 billion or so, because all the plans for these brand new nuclear power plants, which were supposed to be the crown jewel of Obama's entire new energy plan, basically just went completely out the window. And so that's $8 billion in research, development, permits that has now gone completely down the tubes. And again, you begin to think who would profit from a quake like this in Japan. And it seems most obvious that it would be the Russians, because the Russians are now the number one producers of oil on the planet. That they're putting out about 9.5 million barrels a day. The Saudis are putting out about 8.8 million a day. The Canadians are somewhere about 8.2. The U.S. is still putting out somewhere like 7.5 million barrels per day. But it basically wiped out the global plan for cheap, clean nuclear energy, even something that they were calling nuclear pebbles, which is actually far safer than actually having the control rods and whatever else. So that's $8 billion out the window, number one. Number two, if you look at what the quake actually did, you have, again, I was saying, a 176-mile rip in the Earth's crust, about 176 miles long, 26 miles wide. The continent, the actual island of Honshu, moved 17 feet. That's feet, mind you, not inches, but feet closer to the United States. The island itself sank about 20 feet or so when the wave was actually rolling in. It altered the axis of the planet by 6.5 inches and actually sped up the rotational frequency of the planet by about 2.5 milliseconds. And it's interesting because the rotational frequency of the planet had been slowing. And another thing that global scientists were worried about was that if the rotation of the planet begins to slow past a certain level, that we would begin to lose magnetic field on the planet as well, which is something else that they were worried about, because it's that magnetic field that holds in the atmosphere and helps protect us from a lot of other different things. And so we've had two earthquakes now, the Chile earthquake last year that was 8.8, that slowed us down by about, like a whopping like 5 milliseconds or so. So we've had two big quakes now that have actually sped up the rotational frequency of the planet. And if you look
Wait just a minute. You said the Chile quake slowed us down.
No. I'm sorry. The Chile quake sped us up. The Chile quake, the 8.8 quake in Chile actually sped us up. The Japan quake also sped us up, but they were worried about the actual rotation of the planet actually slowing. But these two quakes have actually sped up the rotational frequency of the planet, the rotation of the Earth. Okay, we good with that?
I'm good with that.
Okay, so if you look at where the quake actually happened, and this is kind of a weird thing because I've got like way too much time on my hands. If you draw a line and you understand, once again, not only torsion field physics, but if you understand that there's a tetrahedral mathematics, in other words, like a triangle, there's three points on the Earth's crust that are just above the Tropic of Cancer that are very interesting. If you look at the Great Pyramid of Giza, which, again, is the most massive structure on Earth, it's 30 times the mass of the Empire State Building. It was the tallest building on Earth. It's 455 feet. It was the tallest building on Earth until they built the Eiffel Tower. The thing sits on a 25-acre perfect level that's actually slightly curved because they actually knew the entire mass and circumference of the planet. And it just so happens to sit dead center of all of the landmass on Earth. Well, if you draw a line from the Great Pyramid of Giza and draw a straight line at 19.33 degrees west, you actually come to, and you draw it 120 degrees, a circle around the Earth, which is 360, you draw it 120 degrees west, you come up right on top of the British Petroleum Deepwater Horizon oil rig that, of course, blew and then, you know, just coughed all this oil up into the Gulf, which has a number of different effects. Number one, it wipes out much of the fishing. Number two, it wipes out local small businesses there. Jesse Ventura just did a very interesting piece where FEMA was talking about having like $40 billion to buy people out and move everybody out of there. It is interesting that after the Rita and Katrina hurricanes, Halliburton came in and bought up much of the land that was destroyed by the collapse of the various bridges in the Ninth Ward. So it's very interesting to me to watch in essence, a oil rig that only had licenses to drill down 16,000 feet, that instead went down well over 35,000 feet or so, even though they didn't have permits to do it. And even though they were getting perfectly good oil at 16,000 feet or so, they in essence drilled into an asphalt volcano that then they just allowed to bleed into the Gulf for months. So if you're thinking that they do have the technology to fix it, which they did, and James Cameron had to then testify to Congress to say, this is easy, why aren't they doing this? And I can tell you how to fix it, and I know they've got the technology, and they eventually wound up doing what James Cameron told them to do, to actually plug it. You know that British Petroleum knew that it was going to happen in advance because the head of BP sold all his stock. So all these really interesting things about this conspiracy of people that knew it was going to blow, and then let it bleed. And you're thinking, all right, why? Especially when they took the cap off it and there was a lunar eclipse that went right across the top of it. So there's a lot of very interesting gravitational things that are happening to actually bleeding that volcano, which are now affecting the rotational frequency of the planet. Now, bear with me. You've got, okay, so 120 degrees, you go and you hit the deep water horizon. If you go from Giza and go another 120 degrees, this time east, you come up right in the Sea of Japan, actually directly off the coast of Japan, right at the edge of the it's actually at the lower part of the island. Interestingly enough, one of the things they found at this tetrahedronic point is this huge underwater city that's being explored with these giant blocks, and there are a lot of people that thought it was part of ancient Lemuria or some kind of but they're finding these large ancient structures in this area, but it's right along the edge or the crest of the area that if you push down on that area, it then pops up exactly where the quake actually came up at. So I'm just noticing this, Kevin. I'm just noticing that you've got these three points. You've got Giza in the center, you've got the Deepwater Horizon, and now you have the pyramid, and now you have this earthquake in Japan. If I was thinking about the planet slowing down, or if I was thinking in terms of the tetrahedronics or the mathematics of it, literally, and remember, we're talking about the Mayan calendar also. If the Mayan calendar ends in 2012, why? Is it because the Mayans were so fussy and so anal, if you will, about their calendar that something was going to happen to the rotational frequency of the planet, that the planet would slow or speed up or whatever was going to happen that would not allow them to actually judge time, in other words, in terms of a 24-hour rotational cycle of the planet? Now, I know this is kind of a wild James Bond, sort of Ernst Stavro Blofeld sort of I've been talking about this for months, saying watch what's going to happen at the edge of Japan, because something's got to happen there in order to balance out whatever it is I think they're doing, and then it happens. That's what I'll take credit for, saying, look at this area of the world, look at what's going to happen, there's going to be some kind of massive movement of the Earth that's going to do something right off here, even though I didn't predict the actual the timing of the quake as I have in the past. But so that's the interesting part about this. And at the same time, you have magnetic north now moving, no longer moving north as it has been since 1945, but now moving rather suddenly and very dramatically east by almost 100 miles. So you have a shift of the poles because of the Japan quake by 6.5 inches. You have something that occurs actually beginning in December 9th of 2009, the same time as the bomb.
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll be back right after this, folks, so don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Sean David Morton. And, Sean, before we get too far down the road here,
okay.
It sounds to me like what you're saying, or at least it sounds like where you're headed with this, is that the earthquake in Japan was triggered on purpose by person or persons unknown, and that the BP oil disaster in the Gulf was purposely triggered as well. Is that where you're headed with that?
Well, I don't have have any proof about the... Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, I don't have any proof of the Japan earthquake. I know there's a ton of stuff out there right now as far as people talking about the HARP project, and there's a man named Benjamin Fulford who believes that this was triggered, and you know, we've been using weather modification and earthquake technology for quite some time, literally as a covert a weapon of covert warfare. But I don't have the smoking gun, and I don't have a person that says, you know, we've absolutely done this. But when you consider that there was no warning of the quake whatsoever, they have the best advanced early advanced warning system on Earth, and you had one of the largest earthquakes in history just rip open all of a sudden. It's interesting. Now, as far as the BP oil spill, yeah, they absolutely knew that it was going to happen. They knew it was coming down. There was a very, very concise conspiracy that had to do with either incompetence or greed or something actually triggering it to some kind of greater agenda. Now, I know this sounds like a grand conspiracy theory, but, Kevin, when you take into effect the bizarre, because all the stuff that's been going on, I mean, if you're down under and into it like I know you are, if you start in 2009 in December with this bizarre spiral over Oslo, Norway, the same day that Barack Obama is there to win his Nobel Peace Prize, and again, it's you know, now he's at war in Afghanistan, he's at war in Iraq, he's at war in Libya, so you can imagine how many wars we'd be in if he didn't win the Nobel Peace Prize for peace. The fact that he's there with all of these world leaders in Oslo, Norway, and you then have this bizarre spiral that appears in the sky, which was created, and I have absolute documentation for this, which was created by the Nordic Scandinavian version of HARP, which is called EISCAT, which is actually the incoherent scattered array is actually what it's called, and they turned this thing on and like everything browned out in the country, and there was a whole baffle of these projectors that actually created this hole that, in essence, in my opinion, was some kind of black hole or zero point energy that was actually designed to draw energy off the sun. It was between here and the sun when this phenomenon occurred. They blacked out Soho. They literally blinded Soho for 33 hours or so, so we couldn't see what was going on with this anomaly. At the same time, on December 9th of 2009, you had a huge gray pyramid, a tetrahedronic pyramid, that actually parked itself over downtown Moscow for the better part of 2 days. Now, it's interesting because they reported there was some kind of cover-up that was going on, because on the one hand, they were saying that the pyramid or the triangle that appeared over Moscow was on December 17th, and yet the various Russian news agencies actually reported on December 9th at the same time that this weird spiral is going on. So, look, it's not like these guys pick up the phone and call me and say, hey, Sean, this is what we're doing today, and here's how the conspiracy is working. It's my job to take all these kind of incoherent pieces of information and try to piece something together as part of the puzzle. And, you know, with where I figure, because I know where they're going, and I understand that they take prophecy very seriously, they take the Mayan calendar very seriously, they take the Great Pyramid of Giza very seriously, they take remote viewing very seriously, but when you have all of these things coming together, when you have, for example, Terence McKenna's Time Wave Zero software that is based on the I Ching, that then creates a spike that is greater than World War I, World War II, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and the fall of the Roman Empire combined, occurring where his software just ends on December 21st of 2012. When you have Cliff High and his WebBot programs claiming that the WebBots can't see anything between December 21st of 2012 through almost May, where the WebBots literally just kind of jump off a cliff and suddenly you have this great null space. When you have crop circles appearing in the fields of England that are now predicting not only eclipses, a very specific eclipse that's going to occur next year in 2012, that's going to be highly significant, because the eclipse that occurs on May 20th of 2012, and there's a crop circle that points to this particular eclipse as being very significant. The eclipse begins in Japan, directly over what I believe is the sixth chakra, or the third eye of the planet, over Osaka, Japan, moves across the Pacific, and then comes in, and the penumbra of the eclipse actually comes in over Eureka, California, and directly off the coast of California, which is the very top of the San Andreas Fault. And then the penumbra of the eclipse, or the eclipse is going to last about, I think it's about 9 or 10 minutes or so, but the penumbra of the eclipse is going to be directly over Mount Shasta, California, which has been talked about for many years as being an interdimensional, hyperdimensional vortex, as being the supposedly underneath it is a Lemurian city called Telos. I mean, there's all these legends and myths about the occult and mystical power and the UFO phenomenon that occurs around Mount Shasta. And then it's going to cut across the United States, eventually going over Reno, going over St. George, Utah, and eventually petering out somewhere around Lubbock, Texas or so. But for the first time in 26,000 years, you are now going to have a direct alignment of the constellation of the Pleiades and the sun and the moon in a direct straight line over, not only will it be in a, they'll be in a direct straight line over Mount Shasta, but in a partial eclipse over the Mayan pyramids of Tikal and Palenque and Chichen Itza. And now the Pleiades, on the 20th of May each year, beginning in the year 2000, began to cross the tops of these pyramids. In other words, began each year on May 20th to align with the temples at the top of the pyramids, showing that the year 2000 was going to be unique, that it was beginning a new age, that there was going to be some kind of interaction with the Pleiadians that was going to have something to do with the uplifting of mankind. I told you this war that the Egyptians believed between the reptilian gods of Set or Seth or Sutek, who were constantly at war with Osiris and Isis and Hathor and Anubis and whatever else. So it's very interesting, because then 16 days later, and there's a very interesting crop circle that they actually use, I believe, as the symbol for that program on History Channel of Ancient Aliens. But at the bottom, you see an eclipse, a partial eclipse, and the eclipse is partial over the Yucatan. You see all this time coding around the outside that represents 2012, and then you have 16 flanges that come off the bottom of the eclipse, and the eclipse is over what looks like a Hopi cross. In other words, it's like a flared Roman cross or a flared Hopi cross with these 16 flanges on it. So I started looking at it, realizing that these flanges were representing days of time, and I began just looking at my almanac, having an astronomy background and an astrology background. I started looking in the almanac, saying, "Well, what happened 16 days after the eclipse?" And lo and behold, 16 days later, you then have another astronomical phenomenon that is incredibly rare, which is called the Venus transit, where Venus moves across the face of the sun for 8 hours on June 8th of 2012. So on May 20th, you have this eclipse, where for the first time in 26,000 years, the Pleiades and the sun and the moon align in a direct straight line over Mount Shasta and over the central part, eventually ending at what they call the Heart of the Dove in Lubbock, Texas, if you will, in the center part of the blessed continent of America. And then 16 days later, you have this Venus eclipse, which is supposed to, once again, lift the veil on the right-hand side of the brain, re-empower the feminine, all about the redemption of Eve and all about the female version of Quetzalcoatl and the American Indian prophecies of the return of the white buffalo calf woman. Now, the last time Venus transited was 6/6 of 2004. So on June 6th of 2004, it opened this stargate, if you will, this energy into the right-hand side of the brain, and now it's going to seal that energy as the Venus transit occurs on June 8th. Of 2012. And then, of course, there's one other eclipse, I think November 13th of 2012 as well, which is over the southern hemisphere. And then, of course, you have the December 21st date, which is now finally the first alignment of the sun with the center of the galaxy in 26,000 years, which, by the way, all the pyramids and all the stuff down in the Yucatan and Guatemala is all aligned for that to be some kind of cosmic day that is the end of a calendar that began in 3115 BC. And what actually geologists have told us from Princeton and Harvard, that in 3115 BC, that there was a massive catastrophe that struck the Earth that created a massive glaciation that created the woolly mammoths and ice, that created the Austrian Iceman, that created these massive glaciers in Peru. And they said that whatever happened in 3115 BC did not happen over hundreds of years or thousands of years or months or even weeks, that it happened in days. that in days this occurred. And this was the one special on the Discovery Channel that really just scared the snot out of me, because I'm watching all these guys dig down into the ground saying, this is when all these calendars began. It's when the Hindu calendar for the Kali Yuga began. It's when the Mayan calendar began. It's within about 50 years of when the Hebrew lunar calendar begins. And again, we seem to be hurtling towards this grand final act, this great Dumont of massive solar flares, of true north and magnetic north moving towards each other, of a series of earthquakes that are speeding up the rotational frequency of the planet. You know, and the one thing when the Japan earthquake happened, and I was on a bunch of radio shows talking about it, I was saying, well, you know, 2012 doesn't look so funny now, does it? With, you know, things like that actually occurring. And now when you believe that now these quakes are going to start walking clockwise, around the Ring of Fire up into Alaska and then into Canada and then into Washington and possibly down into California. And when you then take into effect the bizarre weather that's been occurring, which I did predict because I told everybody on the East Coast, look, when the poles move 100 miles, you have the Siberian Express, all this cold that's supposed to be going down in the center part of the country, all this has now been diverted, and it's now going to start dumping snow on the eastern seaboard, which is now bringing around the, you know, what they call the snowpocalypse and snowmageddon and all these other things. So you actually have a climate change that's occurring, not because of any sort of global warming, but because the actual magnetic pole of the planet is now completely untethered from the center of the Earth and is now moving at a pretty steady clip towards Siberia.
All right. Now,
I took a breath, Kevin. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I'm loading all this stuff on you,
man. Oh, it's very, very interesting, and you've given me a bunch of stuff here I need to ask you about. All right, let's go back to these disasters being triggered. Who benefits?
I hate to say this, but the whole planet actually benefits. I know how horrible that sounds because of all the disaster that's occurred in Japan. But when you're talking about a possibility of maybe 20,000 casualties or so, which is eventually will probably be more like 30,000 by the time they're done with it, you know, you have to start thinking like they do. I mean, you know, I went to the University of Southern California where, you know, I knew the Rothschild kids and I knew the May brothers and I knew kids worth billions of dollars. And you got to think like them. If I was them, and if you and I were them, Kevin, and we're looking at the fact that, you know, we don't just own companies like Bill Gates. You know, we own France. We own the United States. We run the mother corporation that sets up countries as franchises, if you will. And we're looking at our investment. And our investment is the Earth. And our slaves are the people who run around on the face of the Earth, who we've got basically bagged and tagged. You've got your Social Security numbers, and you've got your bond number on the back of your SSN card. And, you know, we've pretty much got you wrapped up. You begin to think to yourself that real estate is obviously pretty dear in this part of the galaxy, and there's not a lot of planets like this. What do you do? On the one hand, you've got people who are out there, you know, yelling and screaming on the rooftops with their hair on fire, claiming that there's a global conspiracy to wipe us all out, that they're going to wipe out, you know, that the Georgia Guidestones say that the approximate population of the planet should be something like 500 billion or so. And that they're building
500 million.
They're all going to hide, you know. But then you come out. Once you come out of that hole, what are you then the king of? I mean, are you just the king of, you know? Are you the king of pain? Are you the king of dust? Do you basically come out in a big pile of rubble? And so I would think that who benefits from this are the people who are actually looking at this, thinking, "Look, something's going to happen," and it's not just right in 2012. It starts in 2012 when the alignment occurs. That's the trigger. I mean, that's the beginning. Everybody's, you know, 2012 is going to come and go, and people are going to go, oh, well, that wasn't so bad, and all these, you know, I saw the movie, and this is nothing. And what we have to worry about is we got to worry about 2013 and 2014. And remember that what people seem to miss is that now that the sun has aligned with 27 degrees Sagittarius of galactic center, that means that we're going to be aligning with that every time the Earth comes around the sun. That means every 21st of December now, for about the next 300 years, we're going to get pounded by this pulse of energy that's being amplified by this gigantic black hole, this mile-wide black hole at the center of the galaxy that seems to be rotating and it's like 11-minute intervals, whatever this pulse is coming out of it. So, you know, there's a lot of very interesting things that are going on. You know, on the one hand, I think it's, I, the Mayans also say that it's the beginning of a golden age, that it is the one man can't be the slave of another, and the winds of change sweep away hierarchies, and that governments begin to collapse. But if you're invested in that, if you own the governments, if you have the strings, if you're controlling the puppets, that's not a good thing. You don't want chaos. You don't want mass destruction. You want everything the way it is, because you are very slowly cooking the frog by very slowly turning up the heat in the pot to make sure that the frog doesn't jump out of the pot. And it's like, you know, my dad used to tell me, he said, look, my father was freer than his grandfather, and he says, I'm freer than you, and you're going to be freer than your children. And he says, because they are just, every year, they just keep tightening down the screws, and something's got to snap. And it's snapping now, because I'm telling you, in 2012, people, and I know you're not, you don't have a political show going on, and people are going to wake up and say, what the heck happened to my country? And I'm going to say, well, you know, it started happening in 2010. Why weren't you paying attention?
It started happening 30 years ago.
Well, I
hear people say, we've got to get everybody to wake up. Well, it's too late to wake up. I mean, it's fine. Go ahead and wake up. Too late to do anything about that. It's on now, and we'll just have to ride the wave and see what happens.
But that's it. You said it exactly correctly, because right now we're in what the Mayans call the ninth wave. And the ninth wave, if you can imagine this, what they're pointing to and why it's so important, and it's not even the Mayans, it's actually the Olmecs. The Olmecs were the ones, which means rope of time. But the Olmecs were a much more ancient race.
Mm-hmm.
The Mayans, I think, just came along and just kind of found all this stuff. You know, very much like the race that we call the Egyptians kind of stumbled upon the pyramids and kind of redecorated them. And, you know, it was probably Atlanteans before them, or, you know, whomever. But the ninth wave represents that their belief structure is that the universe is 16.4 billion years old. And that in that 16.4 billion years, the universal mind of the Creator has developed us into what it is we are, and we've gone from organized as cellular beings to then mammals, and then from mammals we've created families, and from families we become aware of ourselves as tribes, and as tribes we become aware of ourselves as regions, and then as regions we become aware of ourselves as nations, and as nations we've now just become aware of ourselves as a planet. And that in the last, beginning in January of 1999, we began the Galactic Week, which is us aware of ourselves as what our place in the galaxy is. And now the trigger is going to be, I believe, the May 20th date, or Dr. Carl Kalman talked about March 9th being the date. But it basically means between now, whether or not it's 260 days or, you know, 365 or whatever, between now and December 21st of 2012, their belief is that we now enter the temple at the top of the pyramids, and that now we're literally hyperactivating. If you can imagine, between now and December 21st of 2012, we are coming to the culmination point of 16.4 billion years of evolution, where we reach that apex and we reach that pinnacle. And the only way we'll be able to do that is by tearing away the veil on the right-hand side of the brain that controls symbols, archetypes, dreams, music, quantum time, fluidic intelligence, an ability to exist and live in the past, the present, and the future, if you will. So it's that veil, that reunification, that redemption of Eve, if you will, that is all about us now having access to all of our heads, to sort of all of our brains. And that's what they're trying to point out, that's why one man can't be the slave of another. That's why the winds of change wash away the hierarchies. Well, when that happens, you're going to see chaos like they have in the Middle East. You're going to see governments begin to collapse. You're going to see transparency in government, and people are going to start realizing for the first time, you know, what's really being done to them. And you know, I also think that the planet has a planetary energy system, a chakra system, if you will, and that the base root chakra is Lhasa, Tibet. The prostate ovarian chakra is the Great Pyramid of Cairo, Egypt. The solar plexus is Stonehenge, where all of these amazing crop circles are going on. The heart chakra, or the crystal city, is Machu Picchu, which is the the lungs of the planet, if you will. The throat chakra, or the voice of the world, is downtown Los Angeles, because it's the heart of the movie industry, the radio industry, the music industry. It's literally the city of angels, which are the communicators or the messengers of hell. And that the third eye is a little place outside of Osaka, Japan, which is called Tenri City. And there's actually a huge red granite pillar that's one of the most sacred spots in Japan, which is called the Kaudi Dai. And this red granite pillar, they believe, goes directly into the third eye. And even the symbology of the Japanese quake is fascinating to me, because if Japan represents the third eye, and if you think of the Japanese, what do they develop? They develop things that have to do with vision, with hearing, with everything that has to do with cameras and television and high definition, and all these things that have to do with the visual cortex, the visual auditory cortex. That third eye has now ripped open, literally a hole ripping open, and the symbol of Japan is the red circle, which represents the bindu of the third eye, that spot in the center of the indigo pyramid, at the center of the forehead, that allows you to see truth, that allows you to see through illusion. And the seventh chakra, Kevin, is what you are facilitating with your wonderful radio show, because the seventh chakra is all of us. The seventh chakra is the coming Messiah, is when Christ said, I am the chief cornerstone that the builders rejected. That's the capstone on the pyramid. If I was to hush all the voices, the very stones would speak my name. That's the pyramid he's talking about again. The pyramid which predicts the coming of not only Buddha, but also of Christ, and predicts the coming of another Messiah sometime around 2034 to 2040 or so in the future. But the seventh chakra is us, is all of us coming together using the internet and telecommunications and cell phones and satellites and radios, because that is kindergarten for what the true seventh chakra is going to be, which is a form of global telepathy.
Okay, now using telephones and the internet and all of these communications devices and opportunities that we have depends upon, in great measure, it depends upon an electric grid, but also in great measure upon satellites. And if something weird is going on with the sun, and if we've got a kill shot coming in 2013 from the sun, February, I believe you said, 2013,
Well, I'm quoting this Undersecretary of Defense who said.
Yeah, I understand.
You know, it's
but all of that together is going to knock out communications.
Okay, that is possible. That is, you know, and once again, what are the biblical prophecies that there's silence in heaven, that the stars fall from the sky? It's, you know, it is kind of interesting. But again, do we develop this global telepathy and part of what I'm working on now, too, and I can't talk too much about this, but we're actually working on a series of communication devices that are actually using a portion of the unified field theory that'll have to do with actually communicating using gravitational waves that will not need infrastructure. And if we're in doing this, and we're talking to some pretty big companies now about putting this together, but we're talking about a series of communications that will need no infrastructure and be able to instantaneously communicate almost unlimited data from one point in space to any other point in space, literally anywhere in the solar system or anywhere in the galaxy. So you could be a satellite at the orbit of Pluto and there wouldn't be a 9-hour time delay, or you could be at the bottom of the ocean. And what we're in the process of doing is actually developing a communication system that, again, is not going to rely on cell phone towers or any kind of connected technology at all. No
interest. All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back right after this. Well, Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Sean David Morton, and we're talking about all kinds of stuff, folks, but related to what's coming up. A lot of people are very, very concerned about what's coming up in 2012. I have been saying, Sean, that it's not December the 21st, 2012. You don't wait till then and say, okay, this is the big day. It's an earthbuster. But there will be a crescendo of disasters between now and then. And that I think, this is my opinion, based on the fact that if there's validity to the Mayan prophecies, our prophecy, and validity to that calendar, the end of that calendar signals the end of an age, the beginning or birth of a new age. So we have a crescendo going up to December the 21st, 2012. And if there's validity to all of that, then December the 21st, 2012 is, its significance would be that that's the end of an age of pain and the beginning of a new age in which things start getting better. It doesn't mean they get better immediately, but it starts the trend away from the age of pain into a better age. That's what I've been saying about it. That's the way I see it. What do you think about that?
Well, you're absolutely right. And actually, it doesn't really end the calendar. What happens is there's another phase beyond that. If you look at the Aztec sun disk, the Aztec sun disk has a guy in the center of it with kind of big ears that looks a little like Obama, which is funny because it's because Obama took the time to actually pose in front of it, making kind of the same face as the guy in front of the wheel with the president of Mexico. But the Aztec sun disk has a face in the center of it where the man at the center is sticking out his tongue, and so it talks about the end of the age of flint, and that the flint is the tongue that spins the lies, that spins the illusions, if you will, and that it's the lies that are then spoken by the tongue or the flint, which causes the fires, which then which then challenge the world. However, the last plate in the what's called the Dresden Codex of the Mayan calendar, because remember, all we have left really are the Mayans. They had 25,000 books or so that were all about astronomy and astrology and pharmacology and herbs to cure every disease. And of course, they were so important the Catholics and the Spanish burned every single one of them. And the only four books that were saved were calendars, because they figured that the calendars couldn't really hurt anybody. And those calendars are then stored in different museums. There's the Madrid Codex, the Paris Codex, the Grozny Codex, and I believe the Dresden Codex. And the Dresden Codex is the most spectacular one because it ends with there's a kind of a black devil at the bottom with a scarlet macaw on his shoulder that's called Seven Macaw. That's sort of the villain of the story, and he has his wife, and they seem to be milking a huge sky crocodile, and the sky crocodile is literally barfing out gouts of water that have what look like oil in it. It literally looks like kind of black spots. So it talks about a water-based catastrophe of some kind. The Great Pyramid of Giza, the pit, if you were an initiate moving through it, talks about a water-based catastrophe. But to agree with what you're saying, the next phase after that is what they call the Age of the Jaguar. And that the Jaguar goes from 2013 to approximately 2025. Now, astrologically speaking, if you look at everything that's going on astrologically, if you look at the chart of the United States, there's some fascinating things going on because all the planetary positions are lining up now for the exact same positioning of the planets that took place between approximately 1766 and about 1780 or so. That were basically the triggers for the American Revolution. The two planets, well, actually, there's three planets that are going to cause a lot of interesting things this year. The first one was the planet Uranus, which is the planet of social change and sudden shocks to the system and revolution and atomic energy, I might add, moving into Aries. And this happened on March 12th. It literally happened within hours of the Japan earthquake. And it's interesting because astrologically speaking, Japan is an Aries country. It's been very warlike in the past. And here Uranus, which is the planet of these kind of shocks and earthquakes and nuclear energy and atomic bombs and nuclear power plants going wacky, moves into Aries literally on March 12th within hours of the Japanese earthquake. And that's going to transit a number of times and once again bring social revolution. It means that once Uranus moves into Aries, which it did on March 12th, that we're not just going to go from marches and people protesting at state houses. We're going to have people burning state houses down. It's literally going to be that sort of American Revolution, you know, Boston Tea Party thing, the revolt, you know, which very much the healthcare thing is, the Obamacare is really triggering. I mean, there was a good comment made that the British only taxed the tea that they threw into Boston Harbor. They didn't force the colonists to buy it. And, of course, that's what's happening with Obamacare, is that now they're not just taxing you, they're forcing you to buy it and hiring 15,000 IRS agents to make sure that you do. On the other hand of this, you now have, of interest, you have the planet Saturn is now in Libra. And every 30 years or so, the United States goes through what we call a Saturn return. And it's very, very interesting because the Saturn return of Saturn in Libra, where it was in the chart when the United States, you know, on July 4th, 1776, every 30 years, the country takes a very radical turn to the right. And this time, what you saw with the manifestation of Saturn is you're now seeing the Tea Party movement. You're seeing, revolts against taxes and revolts against big government and, across the nation. You're seeing, the shellacking that Obama took in the last elections with 60 or so new congressmen. So it was one of the largest turns to the right and one of the greatest turnovers in Congress, I think, in the last 45 years or so. But if you go back 30 years before that, you watch the country go from Jimmy Carter into Ronald Reagan. And if you go 30 years before that, you go from Harry Truman into Dwight Eisenhower. So, and 30 years before that, you go from Woodrow Wilson to Warren G. Harding, and it goes on and on. So it's interesting to watch the country turn conservatively. The biggest challenge is the planet Pluto. And when Pluto starts moving through Capricorn, as it did starting in 2008, you see financial systems collapse. Capricorn rules banks. It rules money. It rules infrastructure. It also rules earthquakes and oil. It rules everything that things are based on, the skeleton or the bones of things that are based on. So this whole progression of Pluto through Capricorn, and the last time it happened was, once again, during the Revolutionary War, which was all about taxes and banking and, kicking the centralized European banks and the British banks out of the United States. And, you know, of course, they invited back in. They brought the central bank back in, which is what the duel between Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton was all fought about. So it's fascinating. If you study history and you look at it from a metaphysical perspective, that we're in a pattern now, but we're finally breaking free of it. And again, what you're stating is absolutely true, that the Mayan motto is all is one, life has purpose, God is love, or God is love, life has purpose, all is one. So if you really think about that, it means that if we're all connected together, then that means that we're biologically connected to each other, we're chemically connected to the Earth, and then we're atomically connected to the universe that we're in. And then if life has purpose, then that means that no matter how many low kicks or dirty tricks or rotten licks that people have taken throughout their lives, it means that all the bad, terrible, horrible things that have happened means you are right in the right place and time at exactly the right moment in history to be able to do the things that you're supposed to do. I mean, this is the age of heroes. This is all these prophecies and all these predictions and all this stuff. I mean, we're who we've been waiting for, and I've been saying that for 20 years. And Obama finally used it in a speech where he actually came up and said, "We are who we've been waiting for," because it's what the Hopis have been saying for forever. And if God is love, then that means that the prima mobile of the universe, you could say the didactic reasoning that behind that would be, if God is love and love is blind, then that means that Stevie Wonder is in fact God. But that's neither here nor there. But if you think about the prima mobile of the universe being that everything in the universe is all about love and the greatest flowering and flourishing of every creation in that universe, it makes it a pretty good place. And what the Mayans are promising, and what the Egyptians promise as well, is that there's a light at the end of the tunnel that's not a train. That there is that there are a series of challenges that occur for about the next 15 or 20 years or so, but that the United States will come out of it as as the nation of the 21st century. The United States is a remarkable place, and it's not going to go away all at once. And we are literally poised on the brink of being the only global superpower, of controlling all the oceans on the planet, of having an economy that is, if you take the four next competing economies combined, they don't even add up to the economy of the United States. So it's not going to go away. We're an overconfident but an insecure country because we're very young still. So,
let me play the devil's advocate.
Yeah.
There was a time, as a matter of fact, I was born in this period of time, in which the number one competitor on this planet for the United States was something called the Soviet Union.
Right.
The Soviet Union was massive, and I'm talking about in terms of its power, in terms of its economy, although its economy was never as vibrant as here, it still was massive. The Soviet Union, in terms of its arsenal, was phenomenal, way ahead of the United States. They always had more nuclear warheads by far than we had. In terms of certain types of technology, they were way ahead of us. They were the first in space. They were the first to send a man into space. They were the first to achieve sending a probe to the moon. And they were the first to build and successfully man space stations. So in many, many ways, they were way ahead of us. And literally, overnight, just like that, the Soviet Union was gone. We think that it can't happen here, but I think it can. I'm not saying I think it should. I'm saying I think it can. Events that we don't foresee, events that we can't imagine, could happen, and could happen many of them at one time, and in the confluence of those events, we get up in the morning and the United States of America as a nation would no longer exist. Just as on one night people went to bed in the Soviet Union and the next morning they woke up and there was no Soviet Union. It could happen like that here.
Okay.
Now,
good.
I hope it doesn't happen that way. But I think the best defense against it happening is to understand that it could, and to do everything we can to prepare against those eventualities, to be able to survive through those eventualities. Now, one of the things that could cause that could be a total collapse of the economy. The Great Depression back in 1929 was not a total collapse of the economy. It was bad, but it was not a total collapse of the economy. But if you have a complete collapse of the economy, overnight, the corporation known as United States of America would be out of business. People would have no confidence in either its politicians, thus its government, or in its money. And just like that, they're out of business. We have a break. I'll let you comment on that when we come back. We'll be back, folks, right after this. You're listening to The Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Sean David Morton, And when we went away for break, I had just laid out the case that we hope it doesn't happen. We think it won't happen. But it could, because people in the Soviet Union certainly didn't think it was going to happen to them. And then just like that, the Soviet Union was gone. So I'll give you a chance to respond to that and see what you think about it.
Well, I don't disagree. And at the same time, I think that Soviet power was a chimera. I think it was something that was that the Soviet Union was actually propped up by and armed by the United States. And Anthony Sutton, who was one of my friends and one of my professors at when I went to summer school at Stanford, who wrote a book called National Suicide, made a case for the fact that the Soviet Union would not exist without the United States and without us supplying them with weapons and building them up as a terrifying scarecrow, if you will, to basically create this never-ending war. So to have all the benefits financially of a war, but none of the terror, like the old Star Trek episode about a Mini R7, if you will. So, but remember what happened with the Soviet Union was when the Soviet Union went bankrupt, and the Soviet Union is basically a subsidiary S corp of the Rockefeller Empire. And if you don't believe me, David Rockefeller was at his Dacha outside of St. Petersburg, basically meeting with world leaders in 1989 and 1990 of writing off the various debts of the Soviet Union. And when it became the Russian Federation, you had a group of captive states that broke away simply because the Soviets couldn't afford their military expansion into Eastern Europe. But I might also point out that the Soviets have recovered, or not the Soviets, but the Russians have recovered very well, and within about 10 years or so, because they believed in a theory called abiotic oil and started drilling down about 40,000 feet or so in Siberia, they're now producing a massive amount of not just oil, being the largest oil producer in the world now at 9.5 million barrels, but one of the largest producers of natural gas, which they are giving literally to the Europeans at such cheap prices that it's becoming like crack cocaine. So if Europe was to ever stand up against Russia again, all they would have to do is basically turn a spigot and turn off the natural gas that they're providing Europe, and they would freeze to death. We will go up against the Russians again, probably somewhere around 2020 or so. The fundamental differences of the massively murderous and oppressive system of the communists with that of the United States is that if and when the United States of America incorporated a foreign corporation established in 1871, whose constitution is the United States Code, not the Constitution of the United States, which is the Republic, and there's a huge separation between the corporate United States and the actual legal Republic under the Constitution. If it was to go belly up, again, if you just basically said tomorrow, all right, we're just going to take away all the money, everything's going to go belly up, you know, what's going to happen? Industry isn't going to disappear. Again, the economy of the United States generates close to $15 trillion per year. Our next largest competitor is Japan at less than $5 trillion a year. And to give you an idea, the entire gross domestic product of Japan, of $5 trillion or so, that's the product of 170 million people working, that's the budget of the U.S. government for a year at $5 trillion or more. And now that the debt is building up, and you're absolutely right, 2 weeks ago, the International Monetary Fund basically declared that the U.S. government is bankrupt. It's not just we're getting to the point of where the yearly debt is going to be 14.5 and eventually 15 trillion, which is now going to outstrip the gross domestic yearly product of the United States. But if you then lump into that commitments for Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, and this is the International Monetary Fund saying this. They basically said that the total debt of the United States is $202 trillion. And then in order for them to start paying back the International Monetary Fund, that taxes, which are currently about 14% of GDP, would have to be doubled to between 28 and 35% just to put a dent in what's going on. But at the same time, people are still buying our debt. People are still buying treasury bonds. People are still buying it because the United States, they don't think, is going to go bankrupt. And the United States, again, is the only country on earth that has the infrastructure to be able to pay back these debts and hence make its bonds good. You also remember, too, that we have, for the first time in history, we control the entire world. Nobody goes to war and nobody does anything without the permission of the United States Navy. And the fact that we control both the Atlantic and the Pacific, we control all the trade routes, and we will be the only superpower on the planet. The Russians will get all fussy again in about 10 years or so because they're going to want their buffer states back in Eastern Europe. So, yeah, we're probably going to go toe-to-toe to them again one last time. The Chinese may or may not be a threat. Again, the only thing that's holding China together is money. And once the money begins to dry up, which means if the United States goes belly up, then the Chinese go belly up because they are right now like Japan was in the 1980s on steroids. And if there's a financial collapse in Japan, it means all of the various states in Japan, or China usually goes xenophobic when it has something like that occur. So if you collapse the federal government, on the one hand, it would be the best thing in the world because now you don't have the federal government actually soaking the states. To give you an idea of perspective of this, the budget of the Pentagon in 1 year is more than the budgets of all 50 states combined, which means that if we were to stop the crazy wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya and whatever else, bring everybody home, and literally just seal the borders of the United States, we'd be just fine. We have enough industry here. We have enough food. We could retool Detroit if we wanted to. All of these things could occur, which actually set us at the edge of being the country that will be the country of the 21st century because of our economy, because of our will. And once again, if you blew up Washington, D.C. tomorrow, everything would just devolve to the various states and local governments and county governments and whatever. The big thing is going to be what's going to happen when the Federal Reserve completely loses its mind and what's going to happen when we go into a inflationary spiral where various states are going to have to do something to come up with money. In other words, they're going to have to start talking about issuing scrip. And one of the only states in the United States right now that's completely debt-free and in the black and making money like crazy is North Dakota. And the reason they are is because North Dakota has a bank, the Bank of North Dakota, which has been around for about 93 years. If each one of the states can actually start setting up banks and then on the private side start putting their private assets into these banks, then they can borrow against it on the public side, completely bypass the Federal Reserve, issue themselves script, and then you would have money for schools and roads and whatever else. So, but people don't understand that there's the public side, which is always in debt, which is where they only report taxes and liens and levies. But on the private side, each one of these states and counties and towns has private stock portfolios that are called CAFR funds, which is the Community Asset Financial Resources or the Community Asset Financial Reports. California is supposedly $60 billion in the hole, but we've got close to $170 billion in actual private funds in what they call CAFR funds. But you ask any comptroller why that's not being used, and they'll tell you that it's illegal to actually borrow from the private into the public to use private funds.
Okay, we've only got 20.
But if each one of these states had a bank, they would be able to borrow against it, and because that's the private and the public side. So.
All right, we've only got now about 10 seconds left before I have to start bringing this in for a landing. And I want to be sure and tell people, if you go to my website and you click on Sean David Morton's picture, it will take you to his website, all right? So be sure you do that. Sean, thank you for being with us this evening. It's been fascinating.
Yeah, it was a joy and a delight. I'm sorry about the technical stuff, but you're bright and you're fun and you're erudite and educated and I love you, man. Keep on doing God's work. I really appreciate it.
All right. If you will, just stay on the line with me for a moment as I bring this one in for a landing. Folks, don't forget about the fact that we have, for this week until Saturday, we have God's in the Garden as an ebook available for you to download. You just go to my website. You'll see the picture of the book, God's in the Garden. There's a link under that. If you click that, you can purchase it. It's $9, and then you'll be taken immediately to the page where you can download it. It is in PDF format, so just about everybody should be able to read that, all right? And it's between now and Saturday, all right? My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.